From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! My name is Rachel Corrie. The play, based on the American student crushed in Gaza by an Israeli military bulldozer, has finally found a home in the United States. We'll speak with Rachel's father, Craig Corrie, and her sister, Sarah.
I sat down to type up Rachel's journal writings and try to pick out material to send to Royal Court for their production of My Name is Rachel Corrie. It was a very emotional process, but we just got off seeing a wonderful production of the play, and it's been a very amazing experience.
And we go to Gaza to get an update on the latest there and speak with a doctor who founded the Rachel Corrie Children's Center in Rafah. Then Oscar-winning actor Vanessa Redgrave is in the United States to present a Human Rights Award to Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen who was the victim of extraordinary rendition. The U.S. government sent him to Syria, where he was held for almost a year and tortured. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has signed into law one of the most controversial acts of his time in the White House. The Military Commissions Act of 2006 strips detainees of the right to file habeas corpus petitions to challenge their own detention or treatment. It expands the definition of an enemy combatant and gives the president the power to detain them indefinitely, including U.S. citizens. Secret and coerced evidence can be used to try detainees held in U.S. military prisons. The bill also immunizes U.S. officials from prosecution for torturing prisoners who the military and the CIA capture before the end of last year. On Tuesday, President Bush held a signing ceremony at the White House.
This bill spells out specific, recognizable offenses that would be considered crimes in the handling of detainees, so that our men and women who question captured terrorists can perform their duties to the fullest extent of the law. And this bill complies with both the spirit and the letter of our international obligations. As I've said before, the United States does not torture. It's against our laws and it's against our values.
Outside the White House, a number of demonstrators were arrested at a protest that drew more than 100 people. The activists wore orange jumpsuits and brandished dog leashes to represent the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo. This is an unidentified protester.
We reject that the act repudiates a half century of international precedent by allowing the president to decide secretly and unilaterally what abusive interrogation methods he considers permissible.
The administration wasted no time in putting the law into action. The Los Angeles Times reports within 2 hours of the signing ceremony, the Justice Department moved to dismiss dozens of lawsuits filed by detainees challenging their imprisonment. Meanwhile, lawyers for prisoners and rights groups say they'll press ahead with challenging the law in court. This is Vincent Warren, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
There are no guarantees and there are no safeguards for people who are being charged with terrorist activities to see the evidence against them. And if you can't see the evidence against you, you can't fight the evidence against you. This is not about finding out the truth.
In other news, the Bush administration has issued the first full revision of U.S. space policy in a decade. The Washington Post reports the new national space policy rejects future arms control agreements and asserts the right to deny access to anyone, quote, hostile to U.S. interests. The new policy's increasing concerns the U.S. is seeking to revive plans to introduce space weaponry. Michael Crepon, co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center, said, quote, the Clinton policy opened the door to developing space weapons, but that administration never did anything about it. The Bush policy now goes further, he said. In Iraq, the U.S. military is approaching its highest monthly death toll in nearly a year. 10 U.S. troops have been killed in the last day. All but one were killed in attacks around Baghdad. The killings bring to 67 the number of U.S. soldiers killed this month. The deaths were announced just hours after Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told reporters at the Pentagon the U.S. military is too strong to lose the war in Iraq. In other Iraq news, the Iraqi government announced Tuesday the dismissal of its two senior police commanders. The two officials led Iraq's special police commandos and its public order brigade. The units have come under scrutiny over allegations they've been heavily infiltrated by Shia militias. The firings come as Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is facing intense pressure from U.S. officials. The White House has disclosed Maliki even asked President Bush during a conversation Monday if the administration is planning to replace him. The White House press secretary, Tony Snow, says Bush assured Maliki of his support. Meanwhile, the Financial Times is reporting the Bush administration has revived its campaign to pressure the Iraqi government to issue a broad amnesty to insurgent groups. American and Iraqi officials initially floated the idea in June, but backtracked amid congressional opposition to granting amnesty to those responsible for the deaths of U.S. troops. In other news from Iraq, new figures show the Iraqi standard of living continues to decline. The Iraqi Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs says one in five Iraqis now live below the poverty line. The number of people living in absolute and desperate deteriorated conditions has surpassed 2 million. That figure marks a 35% increase over before the U.S.-led invasion. The unemployment rate has reached an estimated 60%, while food prices are also on the rise. In Bolivia, hundreds of people rallied outside the U.S. Embassy in La Paz Tuesday to call for the extradition of former President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada and two of his former ministers. The three are wanted to stand trial in Bolivia in connection with a massacre 3 years ago that led to the deaths of 67 people and left more than 400 wounded. More than 60 U.S. citizens took part in Tuesday's protest, including Maggie Fogarty.
Here today as a U.S. citizen who lives here in Bolivia, joining other U.S. citizens today and citizens of other countries who are honoring this International Day of Solidarity with Bolivia by protesting in front of U.S. embassies, in public plazas, in city halls, demanding that the U.S. government stop obstructing justice for the Bolivian people.
The protest came one day after thousands of Bolivians held a rally marking the third anniversary of Lozada's resignation. The Bolivian president, Evo Morales, addressed the crowd.
The government of the United States say they fight against terrorism, against corruption, that they defend human rights. If they truly defend human rights, if they truly fight against terrorism, if this is true, my friends, to defend democracy from an assassin, a criminal, the mafia of Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, Sanchez Berzain, the United States must expel them as soon as possible.
You can go to our website at democracynow.org for our exclusive interview with President Morales at democracynow.org. At the UN, the race for Latin America's open seat on the Security Council continues today. On Tuesday, the General Assembly failed to choose between Venezuela and Guatemala for a second straight day. The Venezuelan government says the Bush administration has been pressuring vulnerable countries into voting for Guatemala. On Tuesday, U.N. Ambassador John Bolton denied the charge.
That's all that we have ever asked people to do. We have given the reasons why we think Venezuela's candidacy is problematic and why Guatemala's candidacy has a lot of merit to it. And countries are making up their own minds.
Meanwhile, Venezuelan U.N. Ambassador Francisco Arias Cardenas called on member states to stand up to the United States.
We want this to change for the good, so we understand each other on equal terms, so that the will of the strong is not imposed on the weak. We have to profoundly thank this nucleus of countries that maintains itself and does not fall under this pressure. More people are in agreement that everything be resolved democratically.
In Lebanon, UN peacekeepers have reportedly warned Israel they may open fire if Israeli warplanes continue flights over Lebanese airspace. The warning was disclosed by Israeli Defense Minister Amir Peretz during testimony before the Israeli Knesset this week. Peretz says Israel will ignore the warnings and continue the flights. Back in Washington, former Food and Drug Administration head Lester Crawford pleaded guilty Tuesday to conflict of interest and false reporting of ownership of stock. Crawford stepped down as President Bush's FDA commissioner just over a year ago. Prosecutors say he lied about stock in several companies regulated by the agency. Two of the companies, PepsiCo and Cisco, were directly involved in hearings that Crawford oversaw. Crawford faces a maximum 2 years in prison and a $200,000 fine. In California, state investigators are looking into a letter that's been circulating among Latino communities that falsely claims it's a crime for immigrants to vote. The letter's written in Spanish and warns immigrants of jail or deportation if they vote next month. Here in New York, a judge has okayed a case that's seeking health damages for emergency workers involved in the cleanup after 9/11 attacks. More than 3,000 workers have filed suit against New York City officials and contractors for failing to provide proper breathing equipment. And finally, in Houston, a federal court has expunged the fraud and conspiracy conviction of former Enron founder Kenneth Lay. Lay died in July, facing the possibility of spending the rest of his life in jail over his role in one of the largest corporate frauds in U.S. history. Lay's conviction was wiped out under the standard legal practice for defendants who die before exercising their right to appeal. Analysts say the ruling will severely complicate legal efforts by former Enron workers and investors to recover some of their money. The ruling may also close the book on the government's attempt to seize more than $40 million from Lay's estate. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's ratcheted up threats of a massive ground offensive in the Gaza Strip. Israeli troops, backed by tanks, helicopters, and drones, have already staged ground operations in parts of Gaza in yet another escalation in the ongoing assault on the occupied territories. For the past 4 months, the Israeli military has led a wave of intense operations along the length of the Gaza Strip. It began after the capture of an Israeli soldier, Corporal Gilad Shalit, by Palestinian militants on June 25th. The Israeli military said its operations were intended to free Corporal Shalit and to halt rocket fire. Early on, the Israelis bombed Gaza's only power plant, and they've kept Gaza's crossing points to Israel and Egypt closed for most of the time. Since the start of the operation, codenamed Summer Rain, more than 250 Palestinians have been killed. One in five were children. According to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, which has investigated each case, that vast majority of the casualties are civilian. Meanwhile, the Palestinian economy has ground to a halt. Unemployment levels stand at close to 50%, and around 80% of households in Gaza are living in poverty. The crisis comes at a time when the two main Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, are deadlocked in their efforts to form a national unity government. Dr. Mona Al-Farah is a physician and community activist who lives in northern Gaza. She runs a blog called From Gaza with Love. She joins us on the phone from Gaza. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy, and hello to everybody, and thank you for interviewing me.
It's good to have you with us. Can you start off by describing the situation today in Gaza?
Today, the situation, the Israeli airplanes, jet fighters are flying over Gaza since early hours of the morning, and it seems that the operation of re-incursion into Gaza is coming soon. The general mood of people are very, very low. People are feeling there's no hope, there's no vision for the future, especially that the political negotiation between Fatah and Hamas reached deadlock, and the general situation is not promising. So people are very frustrated, feeling very low. There's some good news that we have heard. It might be news or rumors about the electricity is coming in the next 48 hours. Even this good news doesn't make us feel happy, because feeling this while the airplanes are flying over our heads and we are threatened every minute by the incursion and going back to after what we experienced all through the last 3 months. So the general mood of the population is not very good, and our Ramadan month is finishing, and Eid is coming. The streets are nearly deserted. It is not as if people are approaching the month, the feast, and it has a lot to do with the economical crisis that we are going through. This is in brief.
Dr. Mona Alfara, there were reports from Italian television station Rai that the Israeli military is facing accusations it's used experimental weapons during recent attacks in Gaza. They're reporting the weapons have led to abnormally serious physical injuries, including amputated limbs and severe burns. This is a report by the same journalists who reported on the use of phosphorus as an offensive weapon in Fallujah, the weapon believed to be similar to the U.S.-made dense inert metal explosive, or DIME. In addition to inflicting major shrapnel wounds, the weapon is believed to be highly carcinogenic and harmful to the environment. Do you have any information on this?
Actually, as physicians here in Gaza and our colleagues in the ER rooms, because I'm not a surgeon, but what we have noticed in the general hospitals in Gaza, that the sort of weapons that has been used this time is different what has been used 2 years ago during the incursion of the Jabalia refugee camp, for example, and different parts of Gaza. So there's difference in the sort of injuries. The injuries are very lethal, destructive, less shrapnels. It is very, very specific, and it aims to kill and hurt, to make handicapped. So that's what we have noticed. But to have proof, we don't have the facilities to investigate what's going on. We are isolated in Gaza. We don't have the real facilities to say that it is such kind of weapons, and it is or it is internationally abandoned or whatever. So I can't give you concrete information about this. But from our remarks, our notice that the increasing number of casualties and number of injured. And the sort of sort and size of the injuries is different from what we have noticed in the previous years.
UNICEF just came out with a report that says the number of Palestinian children killed this year is nearly double those killed in 2005. Suhaib Khadija, a 13-year-old girl in Gaza, became the 92nd Palestinian child to be killed when she was shot during an Israeli attack on Gaza. Overall, I think they're saying Israel has killed more than 800 Palestinian children since the beginning of the second Palestinian Intifada 6 years ago. What kind of information do you see on the ground in Gaza?
On the ground, more than 400 were killed during the last 3 months, and the number of children, more than 80, were killed. Not only children. I can see two-thirds of the people who died were civilians, entirely civilians, who were just caught during the operation and have nothing to do with the goal of the Israeli occupying army. So the number of civilians that have been killed is increasing, and this is alarming. This is dangerous too. That's what we have noticed. Entire families have been killed and vanished during these attacks to Gaza Strip.
You head the Rachel Corrie Center for Children, the Children's Center in Gaza. In a few minutes, we're going to talk with Rachel's sister and father, who will join us here in the studio in New York. Can you talk about this center and why you've named it for Rachel Corrie?
We Union of Health Work Committee, this is the mother organization that founded this children's center in Rafah refugee camp. The center, the idea of the center was to give a place for the children of Rafah during the incursions and during the very hardship times they are facing, to give them a place to distract their attention from the war and what's going around them. So by the time the center was finished, Rachel Khoury passed away and gave her life, sacrificing her life to defend the children of Rafah town in the south of Gaza Strip. So the Union of Health Work Committee, Board of Directors, Administration decided to call this center, to name it after Rachel Khoury, to keep her memory alive, because she sacrificed her life. She lost her life while defending the Rafah children and while standing very strong, supporting position against the injustice that's inflicting on Palestinian people living under occupation. This is the reason why we named this center. There's another reason for naming the center. We wanted to be a focal point to keep the international solidarity movement going with Palestinian people through this center. So the children in the center can the center itself and the children can receive international solidarity groups, people who are supportive of the Palestinian cause, to come to the center and see the children. On the other hand, the children can communicate with the world through the facilities in the center, like the internet, computer and internet, so the children will not grow up hating the others. We want them to grow up knowing that there are still in the world place for people who respect and who respect justice and who are fighting to see the world full of justice, not hate and injustice.
And finally, the infighting between Hamas and Fatah. On Sunday, Hamas accusing Fatah of accepting $40 million in aid from the Bush administration as part of a U.S. effort to topple the Hamas-led government.
This is a big problem here for us in Gaza. This is an internal fight between Hamas and Fatah, because this doesn't make things improve. Besides the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians, the internal affair is making us really very preoccupied. Everybody is occupied by this internal clashes between Fatah and Hamas, and the mutual accusation between both. And after all, in my own opinion, that this is the outcome of occupation. This is the outcome of occupation, what's happening in Gaza. I don't blame the occupation directly, but indirectly, this is the outcome of our life under occupation.
Dr. Mona Alfaro, I want to thank you very much for being with us, speaking to us from northern Gaza. She runs the Rachel Khoury Children's Center there. When we come back from break, we'll be joined by Rachel Khoury's father and sister to talk about a play that has finally come to New York. Stay with us. Samir Gibran here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also in Spanish, in audio and transcript form for any station to take. I'm Amy Goodman. As we travel around the country, continuing our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, tonight we'll be in Troy at the Christ Church, tomorrow in San Antonio, on Saturday at the Bioneers Conference in San Rafael, on Sunday we'll be in Phoenix, then back in New York for next week. You can see the tour details at democracynow.org. Well, this past Sunday, the play My Name is Rachel Corrie finally opened in the United States, here in New York at the Minetta Lane Theater.
This realization that I will live my life in a world where I have privileges. I can't cool boiling waters in Russia. I can't be Picasso. I can't be Jesus. I can't save the planet single-handedly.
Rachel Corrie was killed in Gaza on March 16, 2003, nearly 3 years ago, when she stood in front of an Israeli bulldozer set to demolish a Palestinian home. The play is based on Rachel Corrie's writings before her death. My Name is Rachel Corrie was scheduled to open last March at the New York Theater Workshop, but 6 weeks before opening night, the theater announced it was indefinitely postponing production of the play. They cited the current political climate as the reason for the cancellation, pointing to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's coma and the election of Hamas. The move was widely criticized by artists and activists around the world. At the time, we had an exclusive debate on Democracy Now!, and I read a letter written by Nobel laureate Harold Pinter to the artistic director of the New York Theater Workshop, James Nicola, and the theater's managing director, Lynn Moffitt, the co-editor of the play. Catherine Viner joined us on the line from London. There's a letter today in the New York Times. It's written by Harold Pinter, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Gillian Slovo, Stephen Fry, and it's dated March 20th. The letter was signed by 18 others, and it says, "We are Jewish writers who have supported the Royal Court production of My Name is Rachel Corrie. We're dismayed by the decision of the New York Theater Workshop to cancel or postpone the play's production. We believe that this is an important play, particularly perhaps for an American audience that too rarely has an opportunity to see and judge for itself the material it contends with. In London, it played to sell-out houses. Critics praised it. Audiences found it intensively moving. So what is it about Rachel Corrie's writings, her thoughts, her feelings, her confusions, her idealism, her courage, her search for meaning in life? What is it that New York audiences must be protected from?" The letter goes on to say, "The various reasons given by the workshop, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's coma, the election of Hamas, the circumstances of Rachel Corrie's death, the, quote, symbolism of her tale, make no sense in the context of this play and the crucial issues it raises about Israeli military activity in the occupied territories." And the final line of the letter says, Rachel Corrie gave her life standing up against injustice. A theater with such a fine history should have had the courage to give New York theatergoers the chance to experience her story for themselves. Signed, Gillian Slovo, Harold Pinter, Stephen Fry, London, March 20th, 2006. Harold Pinter this year won the Pulitzer Prize. Our guests, Lynn Moffitt, managing director, won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Lynn Moffitt is managing director of the New York Theater Workshop, in our studio with Jim Nicola, artistic director, and in the London studio, Catherine Viner, co-editor and co-producer of My Name is Rachel Corrie. Lynn Moffitt, your response to the letter.
To the letter? It's a beautiful letter. It actually addresses the issues that we were concerned about. We believe in Rachel's voice, as they believe in Rachel's voice. We want it heard by a New York audience, but we want the voice heard by the New York audience, not the ancillary events that have been that can pollute that voice. So that is the purpose of the methodology that New York Theater Workshop employs when it uses when it develops context for a play. I know context has become a much maligned word in the last few weeks, but that is what we do, because ultimately the purpose of the workshop in producing art is to foster community dialogue, and to do that requires a lot of work just beyond the play that is seen on stage.
But now, you did agree to produce the play, and it was going to have its opening night tonight.
And we still want to produce the play.
Yep.
We still want to produce the play. And the word indefinite, we don't know where that word came from. We never canceled the play. We were having a conversation with our colleagues at the Royal Court about the difficulties that we were having, not only just with the research that we were doing about the project and about the play, but also about, you know, contracts and budgets and fundraising and all that sort of stuff.
Visas.
We were having a conversation with them, and then Catherine's letter appeared in The Guardian.
Catherine Viner, your response.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm actually not a co-producer of the play. I was just the co-editor. So, but as I understand it, we had everything set. Our flight tickets were booked. I was due to fly out yesterday to New York. The production schedule was finalized. Both sides of the Atlantic had agreed on a press release that was going to go out to the press announcing the production of My Name is Rachel Corrie. And then the Royal Court, as I'm told, received a telephone call saying that the play was to be postponed indefinitely. That's where the phrase came from.
Catherine Viner speaking on Democracy Now! In March. She joins us now in our Firehouse studio. She is the co-editor of My Name is Rachel Corrie, also an editor at the London newspaper The Guardian, also joined by Rachel's father and sister, Craig and Sarah. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! As you watch that, Catherine Viner, you were speaking to us from London, had planned to be in New York at the time, and yet here you are, and the play is being shown now at the Minetta Lane Theater. What happened?
Well, we're so delighted that it's finally on, the play's finally on in New York. We always said that it's an American play. Rachel's voice is wholly American and should be heard here. And I think it just shows that the whole controversy was needless. The play has been very well received. Ticket sales are sort of through the roof. Word of mouth is fantastic. And it just shows that New York wanted to see this play all along.
Sarah, you're a key part of this play. You are Cindy's older sister, and you're the person who started this process of collating your sister's emails. Can you talk about that process?
Yes, actually, we received an email from the Royal Court Theater shortly after Rachel was killed, asking if they could do some sort of a work based off of Rachel's emails. And at the time, it was just too emotional for us to be going through Rachel's writing. We knew there was a vast amount of material there. But it also felt very important to us. Rachel was a writer. She'd always wanted to be published. I think it was one of the dreams that she had. And so I felt like it was something that I could give back to my sister in order to sort of allow that part of her life to still move forward. So it was approximately a year after we first got the email from the Royal Court Theater that I sat down and was able to sit down with Rachel's journals. She was in the place. She describes herself as a very messy girl. So these journals were in tubs, they were in closets, they were, you know, in places all over the house. And to sort of...
You live in, and she grew up in Olympia,
In Olympia, Washington. And we actually both lived together. She had moved back into the house that we grew up in with my husband and I and lived together for the last 4 months before she went over to Rafa. So she was living in the home with my husband and I at that time. So I was able to sit down with those journals. I'd take an evening to just look at the journals, read them, gain sort of the emotional need that I had for myself to understand the context. And then the next day I sat down with a glass of wine next to me and just typed them out without trying to edit anything, sort of like a secretary would, just to get the words down on paper. And And that is what became the text that we then sent to the Royal Court for editing at that time.
I watched the play last night at the Minetta Lane Theater, and afterwards you all spoke. You talked to the audience and answered questions. And one of the key parts of this play is the lists that Rachel makes. Can you talk about the process of going through these and deciding whether on earth the Royal Court Theater would be interested in Rachel's list, like when she's going to do her laundry?
Yes. Rachel, throughout all her writing, had these sort of what most people would look at and say these are odd little lists, but interesting in a way. And I'd see these things within her writing and look at them and say, well, what possibly could somebody do with these? But at the same time, they struck my interest. I don't consider myself a writer. I don't consider myself someone that would be good at creating a piece of theater. And I told myself I don't have the right to edit that out. They were interesting to me. And so I ended up just typing them up along with everything else, putting them in, and then that became sort of the piece that wove the different aspects of the play together.
Catherine Viner, you are careful to say you're not the playwright here, but that you co-edited Rachel's letters. Mm-hmm. What about these lists? Can you talk about them? And for people who don't understand what we mean by lists, what's on these lists?
Well, some of the lists are sort of five people I wish I met who are dead, or five people to hang out with in eternity, and it was very entertaining. Some lists are quite sort of functional, but actually convey something very revealing. So there may be a list about tasks to do in Gaza, which sort of showed you what life is like under occupation, just from a list. And it was interesting when we were editing the play how they worked dramatically, these lists, because it became a kind of recurring motif for what you knew, somehow something you knew about Rachel, that she loved making these lists. And you could chart her sort of psychological progress through these lists and how they developed while she was there. They also work really well on stage, I think, and the audience gets very involved in them.
So the people she wanted to see who were dead?
Jesus, E.E. Cummings, Gertrude Stein, Martin Luther King, Josephine. A selection of those anyway, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, this is an excerpt from My Name is Rachel Corrie. In this scene, Rachel sits down and reads an email from her father. An excerpt of the play My Name is Rachel Corrie. Craig, as you listened to that, your daughter Rachel reading your letter, do you remember writing that email?
Oh, yes. The chills are going down me right now. I had such a hard time. That's the only email I wrote to Rachel while she was in Rafah. I'm a Vietnam vet. And when I was in Vietnam, of course, Cindy and I, my wife and I, were corresponding by mail, and that was easy for me, but I think it was hard for her, and I was learning from Rachel being over there that it was hard because I didn't know how she was. We were talking by telephone, and so when she was on the telephone, I knew that she was okay for that period of time, but I was so worried about Rachel after she got over there. When she started reporting about what she saw, the bullet holes next to the windows and stuff, I became extremely frightened for her because I recognized this is a military that's out of control, and I know how much effort I spent in Vietnam to keep the people around me in control and understanding that the other people there are human beings. And I didn't see anything about what Rachel was reporting that indicated that. So I became frightened that somebody would just needlessly harm her or the people that she was with. And so I finally got the nerve to write this email to her. And as it always chokes me up because I had not envisioned her reading this email until I saw Megan doing it on the play. And then it's her reply is the last thing that we ever heard from Rachel. And so her reply in an email back to me, that's our last contact with Rachel.
I wanted to go now to another clip, to Rachel Corrie in her own words. This actually is not from the play. This is an excerpt of the documentary Rachel Corrie, An American Conscience, which was directed by Yahya Barakat. It includes excerpts of Rachel speaking in Gaza about the plight of the Palestinian people.
Sometimes it takes a while for it to set in what is happening here, because I think many of the people here, they try to maintain what they can of their lives. And I think, I don't know, maybe it has to do with protecting their children, that they try to be happy, joke with their children. So sometimes it takes time to it's hard to hold in your mind, you know, the complete reality of what's happening here. Sometimes I'm sitting down to dinner with people and I just realize that that there is a massive military machine surrounding them and trying to kill these people that I'm having dinner with, these families that I'm sitting down to eat with and who are being very generous and kind to me and their children here who are incredibly threatened, living lives that no child ever should have to live. And so it, I feel a lot of horror, really. I feel a lot of horror about the situation.
Rachel Corrie being interviewed in Gaza. Craig, when was this?
That was 2 days before Rachel was killed. And I just like to take people's attention to the scene behind Rachel. That used to be a neighborhood. She was on Abu Jamil's house. Abu Jamil no longer has a house. And of course, Rachel's no longer alive. But that's the destruction that's going on and was going on in Gaza.
The Israeli military bulldozer that crushed her, you are suing a U.S. company, mm-hmm. Caterpillar, that made that bulldozer. Where does that suit stand?
Well, of course, in the first place, that suit is predicated on the fact that Caterpillar knew that the bulldozers that they were supplying to the Israeli military were used to aid and abet in human rights violations. But at this point, the case actually has been dismissed, and it was filed in Western Washington, the U.S. Superior Court of Western Washington, and the judge dismissed that. And I think relied, I'm not a lawyer, but he relied on a misinterpretation of U.S. law, because essentially, under this judge's interpretation, if unless the corporation Caterpillar actually profited from the actual human rights violation, they can't be held accountable. So if, for instance, I was in McDonald's and somebody comes in and starts shooting at McDonald's, runs out of bullets, and I sell them more bullets, I still wouldn't be responsible for that person's actions after they start to shoot again. So, of course, we've appealed that to the Ninth Circuit. And the appeals have been filed, but oral arguments in front of the Ninth Circuit have not yet occurred.
Finally, Sarah, to see this play, always watching you, always watching your family watch the play last night at the Minetta Lane Theater, is it a little bit like your sister is brought back to life?
You know, it can never be Rachel up there on the stage. And I think when we first saw the play, we realized that. We weren't expecting it to be Rachel on the play. But it's very accurate and honest view, I think, of what Rachel was feeling at that time and the person that she is. So, yes, I mean, it's difficult as a family to watch. I think every family member that's been there to see that play says for exactly that reason, it's difficult to watch the play because Rachel's not with us. And you're seeing somebody up on the stage bring her words back to life and bring her a little bit of her personality and her humor back to life. And those are the kinds of things that you miss so much on just a day-to-day basis. So it is. It's very difficult, but it's also very warming at the same time to just have those words, either reading them to ourselves or up there on the stage. It, you know, it keeps Rachel with us just a little bit longer.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Again, the play, My Name is Rachel Corrie, is now being performed at the Minetta Lane Theater in New York. Sarah and Craig Corrie, thank you. Catherine Viner, thanks for joining us. When we come back from our break, we'll be speaking with a woman who spoke out for this play to be produced, the Oscar-winning actor Vanessa Redgrave. Stay with us.
Sometimes I hear a voice calling me, and I don't know where it comes from. Maybe it's her voice that I have lost, the voice of my beloved who's gone. Maybe it's the sound of the blowing wind, and I imagine that she. I can't hear your voice. From time to time I feel something missing.
Someone following me, Shababed, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. It's about Rachel Corrie. And we're joined right now by Vanessa Redgrave, the Oscar-winning actor. She is not in Britain. We last saw her at her home and interviewed her there in London. But today she's in Washington, D.C., and we talk before we talk about the reason for the visit. Vanessa, as you listen to the story about the production of My Name is Rachel Corrie, now finally in New York, you were a big part of it, being at the Royal Court Theatre. What are your thoughts?
I'm very glad that all those who planned and wanted My Name is Rachel Corrie to be seen in America have been successful. It indicates to me a wonderful thing that there are many, many Americans who prefer to know the truth and also want to protect human rights. And Rachel was killed defending the human lives, which is the first human right, of a Palestinian family. And I'm here in Washington, not able to be in New York last night or the previous nights, because I'm here at the request of the Institute of Policy Studies. I'm going to have the enormous honor of presenting their Moffat Letelier Award to Maher Arar and to the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is headed by Mike Ratner, the chief legal firm that worked so hard with Maher Arar to obtain his release and to obtain his exoneration, which the Canadian government has fully recognized subsequent to the special government-sponsored commission of inquiry headed by Justice O'Connor's.
Well, let's talk about Maher Arar. 2002, he's coming home from a family vacation, headed through Kennedy Airport, picked up by U.S. authorities, put in a New York jail for a few weeks, and then he is sent off to Syria. He's a Canadian citizen, but he's sent to Syria. He was born there, though he left when he was 17. The victim of what is known as extraordinary rendition. Can you talk, Vanessa Redgrave, about this term, this practice of extraordinary rendition? He says he wept all the way to Syria, telling the U.S. authorities, his captors at the time, that he would be tortured if he was sent to Syria, and ultimately he was.
Yes, indeed he was. Well, the chief concern about extraordinary rendition is what goes on before a man, in this case Maher Arar, is rendered to a country like Syria, where over the years before he was sent to Syria, both Amnesty International and the United States State Department itself had issued a number of public reports which warned and emphasized that the Syrian government and the Syrian military intelligence practiced torture in the interrogation of prisoners who they held incommunicado for that purpose during the early days of their interrogation. So he was rendered to Syria in full knowledge of both Americans and of Canadians that he would be tortured there. I think the other really important thing is, as I've got the opportunity, Amy and Democracy Now!, is to urge every single person who hears or sees this program to go onto the website and the summarized report of Justice O'Connor's for the Canadian Commission of Inquiry, which exonerated Maher Arar totally of all information that had been posted up and exchanged and shared between Canadian intelligence services and the American intelligence services and the Syrian intelligence services. And that website is www.ararcommission.com. That's A-R-A-R, commission, one word, commission.ca.
We'll link to that website at democracynow.org.
Good. That's good. Well, I hope that anyone watching this program, or everyone watching this program, will download. It is a summarized report of and the section that I read between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. this morning, thanks to Phyllis Bennis at the IPS, and studied very carefully, is there. It's summarized because the full report is 1,200 pages long. The full summarized report is some 364 pages. And the section that I studied in the early hours of this morning is 48 pages. And the judge said in the report, the main conclusion, says the Canadian government, and they quote Justice O'Connor's, I am able to say categorically that there is no evidence to indicate that Mr. Arar has committed any offence or that his activities constitute a threat to the security of Canada. When you read this report, and read it again very carefully, you may draw some different conclusions from my own thoughts on what I've seen and read. First of all, the government and Justice O'Connor's have to be commended for there being a commission of inquiry. We've never had a commission of inquiry in Britain, in the UK, into the renditions, sequestrations, interrogations, and torture practiced against British citizens, both before they were taken to Guantanamo and in Guantanamo. Neither has there been a commission of inquiry, to my knowledge, in the United States. But what is very, very clear, and the judge is very factual, and he says, for instance, one aspect of the Canadian and American lookout requests, these were the first requests that went so that he would be picked up when he came into JFK. One aspect that is highly alarming is the most unfair way in which Project AO Canada, that's a special section that was set up within the Canadian Mounted Police, described Mr. Arar and Dr. Mazich. Dr. Mazich is his wife, Mona. I quote, or the judge quotes, a group of Islamic extremist individuals suspected of being linked to the Al-Qaeda terrorist movement. That's the judge's quote from the documents that were delivered during this inquiry. And the judge says, and I quote verbatim, a description that was inaccurate, without any basis, and potentially extremely inflammatory in the United States in the fall of 2001. And what his report makes clear is that this allegation was based on no substance whatsoever from the very, very beginning. And then other allegations were added, which included the Syrian bout de papier, as it's called in the report, which subsequent to the torture of Maher Arar, which of course was not referred to by the Syrian intelligence, are signed confession. And when we read about signed confessions, in this case, he was forced to sign a document saying, which they put to him, you must sign that you trained in a camp in Afghanistan. Under torture, he signed that and other statements which they had drawn up, just as was done to Muazzam Beg and other British citizens who were detained in Guantanamo. This compilation was passed from hand to hand, from one section of intelligence to another section of intelligence, without a single caveat, as they're called in legal terms, meaning there was never any note which says there is no proof of this allegation. We have not found any proof, or this must have been obtained under torture. So it reminded me, although this is not what Justice O'Connor said, it reminded me of what I know, this systematic and yet so totally out of control and unsystematic and unsubstantiated network or spider's web going to and fro, which ended up with him being tortured and imprisoned for nearly a year. You know what it reminded me of, Amy? It reminded me of a film I saw and then the book that was published about the notorious case of Slansky, Rudolf Slansky, who was interrogated and tortured under the communist totalitarian regime of Czechoslovakia. There are many other such cases.
Vanessa Redgrave, we just have a minute, and I wanted to ask you, yes, even the Conservative Prime Minister of Canada has now lodged a protest with the Bush administration.
Yes, he has, and apologized to Maher Arar.
And now there will be a question of compensation. Could Maher Arar have come into the United States to receive this award tonight from the Institute for Policy Studies?
No, he won't be with us tonight. The IPS, the Institute of Policy Studies, have videoed a message from him. And it's a very, very special message. This is an extraordinary man of great courage, and so is his wife, his mother, their children, and the whole of his family, because it takes enormous courage to come out into the public, to give press conferences, to challenge courts with lawyers, of course, but it still takes enormous courage. And he has suffered, and so has his family, horribly. So it's a very special day, and what's extraordinary is that this man, this Canadian citizen, has upheld the most important human rights values and laws that many, many people have died for and which are now being ransacked and violated by my own government and by the present administration in the United States.
Vanessa Redgrave, we just have 10 seconds. You are an Oscar award-winning actor, part of a family of world-renowned artists. Why focus on this right now?
Well, you see, it's probably connected with the age I am. I'll be 70 next January. I'm a war child. I know why my parents and their generation went into the Navy, into the Army, why they fought to defeat the horrendous crimes and horrors of Hitler's Third Reich and Japanese fascism. So I remember the day Eleanor Roosevelt presented the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that's why I'm here in Washington
today. I'm sorry
today
to leave it there. Vanessa Redgrave, thank you. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.